I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
It's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
But we ain't killing they army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, introducing our good friend Sheldon Richman. This is our new, again, Friday thing. He writes a column every Friday, TGIF. The goal is freedom. And this one is called Trump, North Korea, and Iran. And, of course, Sheldon is my partner, the editor managing something title, my guy at the Libertarian Institute, libertarianinstitute.org. Welcome back, Sheldon. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Good to be back. Thanks.
Hey, man, I'm glad you write such great stuff all the time. You make for a great measuring stick about what's right and wrong, I think. I like the way you put it here. Anti-Trumplandia and philo-Trumplandia. These two warring factions in America right now. And you say that you're nowhere near the two. You're right in the middle, separate and opposed to both of those. So what's a guy like you then think about Trump's trip to Singapore?
Well, overall, I'm happy about it. I got worried when he canceled it. And I was, you know, worried when before that he was threatening fire and fury. So given this particular situation, the fact that we were at war with North Korea from 50 to 53 and basically leveled that place and never concluded an actual peace treaty or a non-aggression pact, I'm glad to see that finally changing. Presidents before Trump should have done this. They should have done it a long time ago. The faltering steps toward this were usually were sabotaged by the American side because of hardliners, conservatives who said we can't deal with a communist dictator. It was okay to deal with a whole bunch of South Korean dictators. You know, they didn't really get democracy until what, like 1987 or something. Mm-hmm. We were happy to deal with South Korean dictators. So I was glad he's finally sitting down, and there's talk about changing the state of war, which continues to exist. It's just an armistice, which means there's not really a state of peace between the two countries. We need that. And I was extremely happy when he said he was going to be canceling the rehearsals for war. I like how we call these war games or war exercises, but they're not really games, and they're not doing crunches, so they're not exercises. They're practicing war, practicing invasion and nuking of North Korea. And for Trump to call them provocative, he didn't need to learn that word from Kim. I saw one progressive critic of Trump say, that word provocative that he used, I bet he heard that a lot during his meetings with Kim. Well, I think even Trump could have figured that word out for himself. If I don't know, name your hostile power of your choice. I can imagine, what would a neocon be saying if Russia and Mexico were practicing rehearsal?
And hell, even if he's directly parroting the brainwashing of Kim Jong-un's mind control over him, so what? He's still right at that point. Of course it's right. Provocative, as you're saying.
And it was the very least he could do. I mean, where's the end of the sanctions and all that stuff? Just stopping these war exercises, it's the very least. For one thing, look, from the point of view of the hardliners, the hawks here, it's not like it's irreversible. And even he said they'll resume if they don't do what they're supposed to do. So the fact that even among progressives it's being reported as the stunning concession with nothing in return, as if you couldn't take it back tomorrow if he wanted to. And I hope he doesn't. I wish it were irreversible. But the fact is it's not. And the way they're running around in a panic, everybody from John McCain to Rachel Maddow – it's just hilarious what they're doing. Of course, it's also tragic, so it's hard to really laugh at. But unbelievable how they are so deranged that they cannot recognize, with the honorable exception of Bernie Sanders, they cannot recognize, and maybe one or two others that I'm not aware of, they cannot recognize that this is a good thing. It could go bad. Who knows what Trump's going to do tomorrow? He could wake up in a bad mood or whatever. But right now, this is good. He was threatening fire and fury, like they'd never seen before, which is going to be pretty bad because they saw a lot of fire and fury from 50 to 53. They leveled every town in the place and poured more jellied gasoline, napalm, on those people than they dropped on Vietnam. Unbelievable. And more bombs than the Pacific Theater of World War II from the U.S. So this is a good thing. Now, Trump, of course, also has to add his usual disgusting twist to it. So they put out this ridiculous video, which was very patronizing to Kim, actually. It was like lecturing him, will you grasp the hand of peace? And, of course, that's Trump's hand. And all that. So it was the cheesiest thing. It looked like a trailer for an upcoming movie. And then also, he's got to pray. You know, he didn't have to praise Kim, as this great, strong leader. I just was watching a video where he's chatting with a reporter or somebody. A reporter said, do you think Kim will come to the White House? And he's saying, you can see him, it's him, you hear his voice. He says, oh, yeah, he should come to the White House. After all, he's a leader of a country, and I'm quoting him, and he's a tough leader. When he speaks, people sit up. I wish that would happen here with me. So why he has to add all this other baggage is ridiculous. But the core thing
here. Oh, I don't care. I like it. I think he should just completely flatter Kim to death. I mean, what do we got to lose? You know what I mean? He's the greatest leader Korea's ever seen. Like, who cares that everybody knows that that's not true? If it makes Kim feel good and it leads to the end of the war and a signing of a peace treaty, who cares?
All right, I'll accept
give him
that.
A back rub right there on TV, man.
I'll accept that.
That's my thing.
But the key thing is to not go to war with North Korea, which would be horrible for people in that region. I know Lindsey Graham said, well, it's not so bad. It'll all be over there, not here. You know, exactly sign on to the Lindsey Graham calculation that if it's a bunch of Asians who die, oh, yeah, a few Americans too. But if it's a bunch of Asians that die, then, yeah, it's not that bad. It's not our homeland.
By the way, our half-Korean anarchist friend Anthony Gregory told me that he thought that video was really perfect for appealing to a North Korean sensibility and to Kim, and that he was surprised that it was like the most competent thing he'd seen the National Security Council do. He couldn't imagine that came out of the White House, but that was really good. Which it clearly, you know, it looked like, welcome, this is your training video at your corporation that you just got hired to, or something kind of production value. But apparently that's, you know, about right. You don't want it to be too slick.
It also had the feel of a movie trailer, right? Like, coming soon, peace and wonderful economic development.
For a sort of lower production value movie, right? Like a B-movie trailer almost, you know?
I mean, it wasn't badly produced.
Yeah.
I mean, given the cheesiness. I mean, I guess in that sense, good production. But pictures were nice and, you know, lots of good photography. Pictures from the devastation after the war, which people don't know about. Americans don't know that they leveled that country. That was a much more urbanized country than North Vietnam. So in North Vietnam, the destruction was, you know, mostly rural area, but there was many more, you know, sort of towns.
I'm glad you bring that up. You know, I've been seeing more and more recognition of that, but in place of no recognition of that whatsoever. So I think a lot of people probably have never been exposed to that. I mean, I know that my entire education about the Korean War my whole lifetime was, you know, Hawkeye and Radar O'Reilly and all this kind of thing. And they never, you know, the horror of war on an individual level, they did make clear sometimes on that show. But they never made it clear that, you know, over those hills, you have no idea the devastation going on that our Air Force is delivering to these people. Like, there's certainly no recognition of that. And nowhere, I mean, you know what I mean? Like, there are movies about Vietnam. There are no movies about the Korean War. Certainly not, like, anti-war movies about the Korean War that would make a point like that. So we just don't know about it. But so then go ahead and elaborate. Like you were saying, again, they dropped more bombs on North Korea than what?
Than the U.S. dropped in the Pacific Theater during World War II. The other thing is they had moved, Truman had moved nukes, you know, the A-bomb to North Korea. They decided it wasn't practical for some reason, but there is evidence of biological warfare, and, you know, very, very horrible, brutal, savage tactics by the U.S. And for what? For what? The communists, were going to take over the United States? No, but nobody believed that, except maybe, you know, some uninformed Americans who were fed this stuff by the U.S. government. But I don't believe anybody in the U.S. government believed that the communists were going to take over the United States. If Gus Hall was going to engineer a coup, if Korea fell, if North Korea dominated South Korea. It was ridiculous. They wouldn't even call it a war, of course. Truman called it a police action and didn't even ask for Congress's a declaration. And you had some great people back then who would have opposed it. Robert Taft, what is known as the old right, those old Republican people who didn't like interventionism. They thought foreign interventionism created enemies for the United States. They were men of great sense. They were sort of, in some respects, the Ron Poles of their day.
Yeah. Well, you know, people can find quotes from Curtis LeMay and from McNamara himself saying that, McNamara is one of them too, but MacArthur is who I meant to say, that I think it's MacArthur who says that he almost puked or something when he saw just the absolute devastation, just burned. They killed 2 million people, almost all with air power, like you're saying, with the carpet bombing of cities like this, burning men, women, and children to death. As you say, napalm, that's the brand name, jellied gasoline. How do you like that for a way to die, as you said?
I have some of that in an article that's linked in this current article that I did earlier on about North Korea. When Trump was threatening fire and fury, because I think the title was something like the North Koreans know something about fire and fury. So there's quotes in there from MacArthur. Yeah, and that was testifying before Congress, I believe.
McNamara in The Fog of War, he talks about World War II, Korea, and Vietnam.
Yeah. And didn't he say something like, we're war criminals? If we lose, we'd be war criminals?
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. No, they knew it. They knew it. And for anybody to say, and you'll even hear libertarians say this, that they believed that the U.S. was going to be, you know, drowned in this sea of red flowing across the world if the North Koreans beat South Korea, is just it makes no sense. They did not. The policymakers did not believe that. Please, first of all, we know now that they knew. That they understood that the Russian military was a Potemkin village. It was a shell of its what it actually appeared to what it appeared to be. In other words, they knew the Soviets were weak and weren't going to be able to do anything with respect to Western Europe, much less the United States.
Well, and as Gareth Porter says about Vietnam, that the whole problem here is, in fact, the exact opposite. It's that that it's the perils of dominance, that the Americans knew that they overmatched the Soviets and the Chinese combined by so much that they thought that we can do whatever we want and we can expand our sphere of influence to keep them out and keep us dominant wherever we want, and they can't stop us. They wouldn't dare oppose us. The Chinese wouldn't dare send their volunteer army across the border to keep us away from the Yalu River. They wouldn't dare, you know, oppose us in Vietnam. In fact, that's what it is. The Perils of Dominance. That's the name of Gareth Porter's book about Vietnam. They're too powerful, and so all they do is dig graves for everybody.
The Chinese didn't get involved with North Vietnam until the U.S. already made incursions over the line, over the border into China. That's
Korea, you mean.
In that earlier article, which is linked to this current article. So anyway, given all that, and there's not been a formal end to that war, and the U.S. backed out of the few deals they began to enter into with North Korea under Clinton and under Bush. The question is, why should Kim trust the United States? Not why should the U.S. Trust Kim? But right. I guess he's got to do that because. I guess he doesn't like the idea of being excluded from the world economy, and so he's looking to accomplish something in that regard, even if it's for his own prestige. I'm not saying I'm not buying the Trump line that, you know, he loves his people. I mean, we don't need to go there, but he clearly wants this. And the only thing he'd ever get out of a nuke would be a deterrent anyway. I mean, he'd know he'd never use it in any offensive way. And he's not suicidal. So,
right.
I don't know what I can't understand it. Well, I can understand it. It's this Trump derangement business. Where you have all these people who, if Obama were doing this, they'd be praising, you know, Obama to high heaven and demanding he get another Nobel Prize. But they can't acknowledge it because it's Trump.
Right.
And, you know,
and then they're the same people who go, look, Sean Hannity is a hypocrite because he would have opposed this if it was Obama. Yeah. But all they're saying is, I'm Sean Hannity now.
Right. No, that's a mirror image. That's absolutely true.
Sickening.
The Republicans, if Obama was doing this, the Democrats and the progressives would be saying how great he is, and the Republicans would be saying.
I really don't understand this. I mean, I know partisanship and people pick their teams, but it just, to me, it comes so natural to hate all presidents and support all peace talks. Like, why should that bend your brain? Oh my God, the dissonance that this horrible president who should be fed to dogs for what he's doing in Yemen is doing a good thing in Korea.
Because they're not for peace.
Shrug. That's easy.
They're not for peace. Did they ever criticize Obama for, you know, all the bombings of civilians and drones and kill lists? What was it, a Tuesday meeting where they drew up the kill list?
They all went to government school where they learned that only Americans have rights and other humans don't really count. That's where I learned that, government
that's
school.
That's a big part of it, too. And the reaction to, I'll go back to the reaction to Trump's, you know, saying that the war exercises will end. It's funny. I mean, I saw I put it up on Facebook, a quote from a high ranking Pentagon official under Obama, Robert Work, I think his name is, saying something like, any day when the U.S. Cancels, war exercises near your border, near the border of China or Russia, is a good day for them. I mean, what kind of self-absorbed national, you know, it's a sort of a nationalist narcissism, right? They don't look at, they don't even realize other people out there. What counts is, yeah, it's got to be a good day for Russia and China if we're going to call off these exercises, you know, that's in right. their neighborhood.
Right. Meanwhile,
there's something wrong with that.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with being relieved that those exercises are going to stop.
Right. And meanwhile, guess who else is into it? The entire population of South Korea, like 88%. And then they even, I guess, coincidentally, had local elections across South Korea where the current left-wing president's party absolutely cleaned up and swept in a massive public endorsement of their triumph here. And you know what? I mean, think about this. I know you already said it, but I got to emphasize again how huge this is. You know, as David Stockman put it in his article, this is finally the end of the Cold War. It doesn't matter all these details about whether they have all the specifics about how the NPT is going to be enforced in North Korea now or any of these things. The point is they shook hands. The point is that, you know, like when Nixon went and shook hands with Mao Zedong, that, you know, they didn't solve all their problems right then and there on the spot. They just said, you know what, let's stop being enemies and let's work on all our problems together from now on. Which has worked and which has been great for everybody. So, I don't know. It just seems like this isn't just good. This is great. This is a history of the world, man. This is a huge, important, imagine a foreign policy event we're talking about that's actually positive. Right? And like you said, a year ago, we're talking about maybe nuclear war here.
And instead of encouraging him, you have all these people. McCain, of course, said, it's a bad mistake to not have these war rehearsals. It'll affect it's bad for our national security, McCain says. When is he just going to shut up?
Yeah, well, and of course, the other part of his statement was, and we get nothing in return, which, of course, isn't true. We got prisoners back. We got they destroyed their missile testing site and their nuclear testing site. They've sworn no more rocket tests or nuclear tests of any kind in the meantime. And they got a handshake out of it. They got a smashing of the ice here.
But who cares if they got nothing in return anyway?
Yeah, exactly. See, this is my thing about it.
We get something in return. When we get something, if we cancel those war games or war exercises, that's what we got in return.
Right. Yeah, and of course, that's the whole thing about it, right, is all the begged questions here about just what right the USA has to demand anything of the North Koreans in the first place, you know, on any issue. And here we have everything to give, nothing really to lose, except that in the words of, in the blatant words of these think tankers on Twitter and on NPR News and whatever, that we could lose our excuse to keep our troops there. And if we don't have a reason to keep our troops there, then we'd have to pull them out of there. And the keeping of them there is its own self-evident good that need never be explained. We have everything to give, we have nothing to lose, and we have no right to make any demands in the first place. It seems like we can afford to be pretty magnanimous here.
Right. I like what Jeff St. Clair wrote on Counterpunch today. He quotes Trump saying, "The world has taken a big step back from potential nuclear catastrophe. No more rocket launches, nuclear testing, or research." And then St. Clair comments, "Let's not get carried away, Donald. The U.S. hasn't agreed to stop testing rockets or halt nuclear testing or research. While Kim is denuclearizing, you're building a new generation of nuclear weapons, keeping the world pretty much on the brink of nuclear catastrophe." Which reminds me, there was a story the other day about how many, what is it, hundreds of U.S. warheads, land and sea, are on hair trigger alert.
Yeah.
At this moment. Why? Why aren't people in the streets about that? Instead, they're... Progressives just are so screwed up. They'd rather complain about Citizens United, like that's the root of all evil. If we only just get that overturned, everything'd be great. And yet they ignore all this stuff, and it's just unbelievable. They're complaining even about the Jeff Sessions snatching kids away from their mothers and sticking them in detention centers.
Yep.
Maybe.
Read Dan Ellsberg's book, The Doomsday Machine. And about these nuclear war plans, of course, it's just like any other plan. It's all written out on some piece of paper that's already got a stamp of approval on it. And so in the event of X, you open up to tab 3 and you follow through with the plan and whatever. And in so many of the cases, virtually all of them, it means genocidal extinction campaigns against the entire population centers of Russia and China. And it used to be automatic, no matter what happens. If it's just one nuke gets dropped in East Germany somewhere or in West Germany somewhere, America would then destroy every single city in the USSR and China. That's what the war plan used to be. It was Dan Ellsberg who changed it to, we'll only kill, you know, a few hundred million, not a few billion in the first week here or whatever. When it comes to how these things go, he calls it omnicide. This is a brand new thing. The ability of the Americans, and particularly, of course, the Russians, to destroy civilization, certainly all of northern human civilization for centuries, and maybe all civilization, you know, maybe all of humanity.
I don't know where the priorities are of these. People were criticizing Trump merely for sitting down with him.
Yeah, it's great. And you know, in fact, Joe Lauria had this great piece where he quotes the Democrats and the New York Times on Nixon's return from shaking hands with Mao Zedong, and all they did was praise him, right? And ever since then, right, the narrative has been only Nixon can go to China. And why? Because if any Democrat had done it, Nixon would have called him a communist, right? Yeah. So he was the only one who could go and do it. But then, and then the idea being no one could attack him from the right. He's Richard freaking Nixon, right? But then, so here's Donald Trump, supposedly the most right-wing president ever, what have you, if, according to these guys. And that's no protection from them attacking him from the right for selling out America to the interests of the North Koreans, or as you mentioned, in the case of Maddow and them trying to spin this all about its benefits to the Russians.
Well, and it just goes to show you, look, they despise Nixon, those people. They despised him. And yet they weren't deranged in the way they are with Trump. They still could look at the trip to China with clear eyes and say, yeah, it's about time, you know, we got off this war footing with China. And they were willing to give Nixon credit as much as they despised him. But the way things have changed, I don't know if it's only particular to Trump or just some more general thing in the political culture, but they're incapable of looking past Trump. and seeing this for the good that it is. So they can't give him any credit. The only time, look, this says a lot. The only time Trump's gotten any kind of credit or respect from progressive types, I'm thinking of Van Jones and a few other people, is when he drops bombs on people.
Right.
What kind of incentive system is that? Make peace with North Korea, you get criticized. Drop bombs on Syria or someplace, and you get praised.
You know what though? It's the same thing with foreign policy, where if you have nukes, we leave you alone, or we, you know, give you the respect. If you agree to give them up, or even the rudimentary ability to make nuclear weapons like Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi did, then we stab you in the back. And so you'd be crazy to give up your nukes. And this is one of the criticisms that's not just blind Trump hatred. It's, you know, even Pat Buchanan says in his article today, basically, that, man, if you were Kim Jong-un, would you give up every last atom bomb? Really? I mean, the only reason Trump's talking to you in the first place is because you got atom bombs. So, you know, that I don't really, I mean, hell, if they can negotiate an end to the war and the Americans can even accept there's the way they did with the Chinese, that the North Koreans have a nuke or two or however many, that's fine with me. I mean, any excuse to ratchet down the tensions and open up relations. But I wonder what you think about, you know, is there really a possibility? Do you think, Kim, if Trump gave him the ultimate security guarantee like Kennedy gave to Cuba, we never did invade Cuba, got to admit, Kennedy promised, and I give you a Kennedy-level promise, we'll never invade you if you give up your nukes. That's the grand bargain here. Do you think he'll do it?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to judge that. Maybe some you know, eminent expert on North Korea would be able to answer that. But I don't know. I doubt if anybody knows that. He may. I just don't know. And look, they have.
I kind of think he will, honestly. I think they've been as much trouble as they've been a benefit.
They have a conventional force that can do a lot of damage on Seoul, Korea. So even if he gives up all the nukes, he still has some deterrent, power because of that. So maybe it is something. Maybe he just decided the nukes were only to get this peace treaty with the U.S. and get the sanctions lifted, and that he didn't really want them in the first place, and they're a big burden. I mean, I can kind of see somebody reasoning like that. And meanwhile, he has these other cards because he can inflict a lot of damage. Seoul's pretty close to the border. He can inflict a lot of damage using just conventional weapons. And so that may be enough for him. I don't know. It's going to be very interesting to see how it plays out. What has me so disturbed is that the people who should be encouraging him are not doing it. It's just unbelievable. What are they going to do if he gets the Nobel Prize along with Moon and Kim? They're going to go bananas. I mean, I proposed in my article today that when they give him the prize, they ought to take Obama's away from his and say, here, give me that, and then hand it to Trump. I think that would be funny. I think Saturday Night Live should do that, but of course they're stricken with the Trump derangement, so they won't do that. But that would make a funny bit.
Yeah, and I gotta admit, I absolutely hate Donald Trump. I've always had just nothing but contempt for him ever since I was a little kid when he was the world's greatest Reaganite yuppie prick. You know, he's just, you know, and always, and I don't remember that well, but I vaguely remember that when he went bankrupt in the early 90s, that I thought that was funny. And ever since he became president, he told the Pentagon and the CIA that as far as it goes with wars against anyone that can, you know, be smeared even really as Al-Qaeda or ISIS or an associated group of any kind, that the gloves are absolutely off. They can, you know, escalated in Afghanistan, escalated all the drone wars and special operations forces on both sides of the war in Yemen against Al-Shabaab and Somalia and all this. I mean, he's as bad. And then getting out of the Iran deal, Like, yeah. You know, it reminds me of people you say, oh, you just hate Bush. And it's like, of course I hate Bush. Look at all the horrible stuff he does. You just love him. What the hell is your problem? And it's the same thing with Trump. He really does deserve to be thrown to wild dogs. I don't give a damn what happens to him. No trial. I've already found him guilty of war crimes. But still, all this Russia shit is bullshit. And, you know, meeting with Kim Jong-un is heroic and wonderful, and we ought to really be thanking our lucky stars that, you know, not to make a celestial bodies reference thing, but that President Moon, you know, has led this and created an opportunity, and that Trump took it to move forward on this. It's great, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And yeah, I agree with what you say. You mentioned Iran. The second part of my article is about, okay, Trump, good work. Let's apply this logic to Iran. There's absolutely no reason why we should be in any kind of war footing with respect to Iran. They never were making nukes, as we know, from Gareth Porter's work, and which has been elaborated on your show many times. So they weren't even making them. And nevertheless, Iran agreed to these tremendously intrusive inspections just so we could get the sanctions lifted and back in the world economy, which is creating such a hardship for the Iranian people. So it's amazing what they agreed to. I guess Trump could say they really tricked us. They in return for getting the sanctions removed, they agreed to give up a weapon they never were making and never intended to make. Those clever Iranians, they sure pulled the wool out over Obama's eyes. They gave up something they never wanted, never had, and never planned to have. That is pretty clever. But that was good for peace. And Trump, of course, is going the other direction than he's moving in with North Korea. So that's really bad.
And I wonder how he could even fix it at this point, even if he wanted to. I mean, he would have to give up greater concessions to the Iranians to get back in the deal. Now, he can't come crawling back. I mean, I guess he could just say, F it, I'm Donald Trump, and I don't care about consistency at all. I'm inviting the Ayatollah to D.C. And whatever, dude. And just shrug and just do what he wants. But it seems like the way that he's done this, based on, as you're saying, nonsensical, you know, arguments, just partisan arguments and Sheldon Adelson and Benjamin Netanyahu pleasing arguments to do it, excuses to do it. How could he even fix it? I don't know.
No, I don't know either. And as I point out, one reason why he's going maybe in one direction, I mean, I can't fully explain why he did his turnaround on North Korea. At least he was getting good advice and good sense from President Moon. Yeah. He's not getting anything like that in the Middle East.
Right.
He's got on one shoulder, he's got the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, who you know, hates Iran and doesn't want Iran to be any kind of influential power in the region where it's existed for, you know, thousands of years. And is a big country with a big population, a well-educated population. On the other shoulder, he's got Netanyahu and all that Netanyahu represents, and they need Iran as a convenient demon so they can justify the repression of the Palestinians by saying, you know, so anytime someone criticizes them over the treatment of the Palestinians, they can say, hey, you don't live in this neighborhood. We live in a tough neighborhood. Yeah, enemies that they created. That's a self-fulfilling thing. So he's not getting any good advice that I know of on the issues of related to the Middle East.
All right, hang on just one second. Hey, guys, here's who sponsors this show. Mike Swanson and his great investment advice at WallStreetWindow.com. He's actually posting some stuff at the Libertarian Institute website now. Really great stuff. The great Mike Swanson, and he's also the author of the book The War State, which is a really great history of the rise of the new right military-industrial complex after World War II in the Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy eras. You'll really want to look at it. The War State by Mike Swanson. Also, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. If you listen to Mike, you'll be buying some metals. You'll want to buy them from Roberts & Roberts. They've been around as long as I've been alive. They've got a great reputation. They take the very smallest premium possible in order to help arrange the very best sales for you at platinum, palladium, gold, silver, of course, and no premium at all if you buy with Bitcoin. They're at Roberts & Roberts. That's R rrbi.co. rrbi.co for your precious metals there. As I mentioned before, Zen Cash, zensystem.io to learn all about this great new digital currency, and which is also a secure messaging application and document transfer device and all the rest there. Learn all about it at zensystem.io. And read the book. It's by Hussein Badakhshani. It's How to Run Your Tech Business Like a Libertarian. That's not the title. The title is No Dev, No Ops, No IT. Those are all one word each, if you take my meaning. No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. It's really great. And check out libertystickers.com for all your anti-government propaganda. I made up most of them. And yeah, that didn't work out with the new website I kept promising you. But now supposedly someone else is promising one. So I guess we'll see if we ever get a new website. But there's still a lot of great anti-government propaganda, and you could buy it at libertystickers.com. Now, one more thing. Check out scotthorton.org. We've been having some server problems, but otherwise, scotthorton.org is a great-looking new website, as you can tell. And if you want a good 2018 model website for your business or for whatever you're doing, your opinions, check out expanddesigns.com, the great Harley Abbott over there. And if you go to expanddesigns.com/Scott, you'll save $500. Yep.
Most
right-wingers, either if they're really like the think tank people, they have a huge incentive to deliberately conflate and confuse on this issue. And then the rank and file, they couldn't tell you the difference between who's on whose side, between Iran and Saudi and, you know, Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda and Assad and Saddam and whatever. They, you know, all that is just them Arabs over there, towel heads or whatever, and then the bad guys, basically. And so they can just bait and switch all damn day, all damn decade long.
And I don't see any reason for optimism there. I mean, he surprised us on North Korea. I don't think we're going to get surprised by any kind of turnaround regarding the Middle East. And I'm not just talking about Iran, but I'm talking about the Palestinians, where he's clearly totally on Likud's side, or it's not just Likud, because even the you know, Laborites in Israel are no better on stuff like this. Occasionally some rhetoric sounds better, but they're not better. You know, they ruled that country with an iron hand for a very long time, and it didn't do any good for the Palestinians. So looking to the labor, you know, as some kind of hope is ridiculous. So he's all lined up with the hardliners. Things are getting worse for the Palestinians. It's an apartheid state. It's an ethno state, although it's a phony ethnic group. It's not really an ethnic group. He seems fine with it. He's moved the embassy. He's got Kushner going back and forth over there. Kushner is essentially Netanyahu's godson, informally. I mean, he's known him since Jared was a young boy, and you know, there's that sort of relationship, even if he isn't formally the godfather. Netanyahu must look at him that way. Although I understand, I did see something about Jared kind of lecturing some of the Likud officials for not being sufficiently respectful of the Trump people. So there are limits, right? You got to respect the godfather, I guess. We're in your camp, but you better be nice to us and don't act like you outrank us. So Trump is a Trump supremacist. Netanyahu is just simply a, you know, Jewish supremacist.
And so this is so interesting. I'm glad I remembered this right. I read this morning before coffee. But the anecdote that you're talking about, where did you get this from? This thing you emailed me? Oh, it's Haaretz. Okay, and it's... And I've never heard of this before. This is anecdote of Kushner telling them that they're overstepping was about what now?
Remember? What was it that wasn't the document something about they wanted to make sure Trump wouldn't acknowledge the nuclear arsenal?
Yeah, and they wanted him to sign something promising that he wouldn't say something about that.
Yeah, I think that's.
I mean, obviously, everybody knows that Israel has nukes. Basically, the policy is what they call strategic ambiguity, right? Like whether or not they recognize Taiwan as sovereign or whatever. They kind of always just sort of go, so they don't officially announce they have nukes. Their policy is, we will never officially introduce them in the region, whatever that means. But they all have, everybody knows they have 200 nuclear bombs or so. Mordecai Vanunu says so. But then there, the policy in the United States is to respect that and for American politicians to pretend that they don't know or to never quite officially answer whether or not they know. And, of course, Charles Schumer and Colin Powell and others have violated that and spoken frankly about it in the past. But anyway, but so now the scene is Dermer comes and tells Jared, get the president to sign this. And this is the thing that Jared tells Dermer. Hey, step off, pal. You're you're over the line here. I just like the anecdote. Interesting. And I'd never heard of such a thing. And seriously, how dare they? What the hell are they talking about? Sign this.
Well, in the Trump reaction, the Trump family is, you don't come to us and tell us to sign something, buddy.
Yeah, we'll come to you, and then you tell us to sign stuff. God dang, man. I'll tell you what. All right, well, yeah, you know what? I got to say, though, you know, we are talking about Trump here, and if there's something that's, you know, a thing about him, for good or for ill, it's that he's very impressionable. And a lot of what matters to him is who flatters him. That's why he flatters Kim so much, is because he figures that's what matters to him. And so that must be what matters to Kim, right? Which is probably true. But so maybe if somebody did, as you said, the media always gets this wrong and the liberals always attack him all wrong. I mean, maybe that's good for the liberals to attack him on this. And then for other people to tell him, hey, we support you on this, man. This is great. And let him think that, hey, you know what? People really hate George Bush, and they hate him because of the wars. That's his legacy, the wars that people hate. And, you know, even John McCain admits now. Did you see that? Even John McCain admits now, yeah, I guess we shouldn't have done Iraq War II. You bastard. After this, you know?
Yeah.
And so it seems like Donald Trump has got to be able to have – it's not that much of a vision to say, you know what, we don't have to be at war. We could just be a normal country in a normal time. We'd call this whole terror war bull and just stop. And Donald Trump ought to be able to come up with that, right? He could do that. Yep. And you know what? Yep. And I know people say, oh, come on, he's just a puppet and he can't do it and this and that and the other thing. And I say, oh, yeah, you underestimate the power of the American presidency. The president could do damn near anything he wants, including fire the top 10 generals in charge until he gets to one he likes in charge to make in charge of the army to do to carry out his orders. You know, I saw someone say that's what FDR did. The U.S. Army didn't want to go to Europe, and FDR fired all their leaders and then got some new guys who said, we're going to Europe, and they said, okay.
Yeah, but the reason I can't – I mean, you make a lot of sense, but the reason I can't rest easily about this, and you probably share this, is that there's two things that I think are going on with Trump. Number one, there is this American exceptionalism. I know he said during the campaign, we're not exceptional or something like that, but I don't. I wonder if he believes that. So there's this American chosen people complex, and then with Trump, there's this chosen person complex, namely him.
Yeah.
So he's the chosen person in the midst of the chosen people, chosen by history, of course. So I just don't see him totally abandoning the empire, and which is why I think explains a lot of what's going on. I mean, he's had a year and a half now, and we're still at war in all these countries. He talks about once in a while we're going to bring him out, but then, you know, that doesn't happen. So I'll believe it when I see it, and we should encourage him, but it's hard to be optimistic.
Yeah. That's the thing of it, man, is you know, you can tell, gets a thrill out of being the tough guy and ordering bombings and this and that and the other thing. That was Obama's thing, too. Remember, Obama ordered the CIA to start bombing Pakistan immediately. On the third day in office, he killed a bunch of women and children in a CIA drone strike. I mean, the wars were ongoing anyway, but that was like a specific thing at his hand, letting some blood to prove what a tough guy leader he is and this and that kind of thing. And Trump's the same thing, but worse when it comes to that. So, and you know, we talked about this during the campaign before he was ever president. And he's nominally better on regime change in Damascus. Doesn't look like he wants to do that. But when it comes to fighting against jihadist types, as broadly defined as you can define it, he's all for it. And from now on, and as he says, take the gloves off, torture them. Hey, even if it doesn't yield good information, they still deserve it anyway, he said. Kill their families. That'll teach them to mess with us. This kind of attitude. He really feels that way in a typical, you know, 70-something-year-old Fox News fan, you know, country club type of a guy like he is. That's pretty much consensus, man. There's no limit on what you can do to this enemy. So maybe don't go continue overthrowing secular dictators anymore. That's getting pretty tired. Any Fox News fan can tell you that, too. But when it comes to killing the consequences of those recent regime changes, oh, yeah.
Huh. Well, my attitude overall with Trump is everybody knows he's got this powerful ego, and I'm all for harnessing that power in the cause of peace.
Yeah. Well, somebody tweet to him and encourage him.
So I'm for the Nobel Prize. I'm saying he definitely has to have the Nobel Prize. His only regret is he'll have to share it with Kim and Moon, but that's the breaks.
Yeah. But you know what? I think he'll like that anyway. I think to him that'll be like a fun little thing. I don't know about his relationship with Moon, but I bet Moon kisses his ass all day long when they're together, you know, so I'm sure it's fine.
I think he's going to propose when they give them the award in, Oslo, they'll have that thing they have at the Olympics where one guy stands higher, you know, the guy with the gold. He'll want a gold one. The others get bronze. And
yeah.
And he'll be standing higher than the other two.
I bet Moon and Kim would both be for that. You know what? All right.
See, if Saturday Night Live had the right line on this stuff, they could be doing great, great sketches. But yeah. Of course, they're terrible.
Hey, you know what? Let me ask you one more thing while I got you on the line here. What difference does it make about Trump's trade policies since taking over for Barack Obama? I hear a lot of rhetoric. I don't know what the actions really are, but apparently he's. You know, picking fights, generally speaking, with China, Europe, yeah. And Canada, too. So what's the deal?
No, this is very bad. He's just put, tariffs now on, $50 billion worth of Chinese goods. It's the same deal as we say all the time on this. Trade is good. He doesn't understand anything about trade. I like what he says. Trade is good, but it's got to be reciprocal. The idea of reciprocity is built into the concept of trade, right? Trade means each is giving up something because they want the other thing that they're going to get more than the thing they're giving up. It's by definition reciprocal. If it's not reciprocal, then it's either a gift or it's theft. So that's not what we're talking about. So he doesn't even understand the most basic thing about trade, that if you and I trade, it means I want the thing that you're giving me over the thing I'm giving you and vice versa. So he doesn't get that. So he doesn't understand trade deficits, trade surpluses, which is all nonsense anyway, because you're only looking at one part of the ledger book. So of course you get a picture that doesn't give you the full picture because you're only looking at one part of it. He talks about how with Canada it's terrible. We're sending them all this money. Yeah, we're sending the money. That's called buying something. You know, my supermarket. I've written about this on Libertarian Institute. My supermarket. I keep giving them all this money. If I stop the picture there, you might say, well, you're crazy. You're being ripped off by your supermarket. Oh, I forgot to tell you. I also bring home bags and bags of stuff I want, you know, like food and other things. That's how he sees trade.
Sheldon, he's a rich guy. He's got to understand this stuff, not?
I don't. And he's a bit, you know, you think as a businessman, of course, he liked to screw his vendors and contractors and stuff. But there's a whole line of them waiting to, you know, would like to get some of their money. I don't know. I don't know the guy. Thank goodness I've never been in the same room with him. Whether he's just a demagogue or if he really thinks he knows this, you know, he likes to say, I have a great brain and I went to Wharton. Okay, I don't know. I don't know if he's just a liar and a demagogue or an idiot. I mean, and I guess you could be both, but either he knows this is right and he's saying he knows he's wrong about that, but says it anyway because he thinks that's what most people will believe. And most people don't understand trade either, especially foreign trade. Or he actually believes what it is he says, in which case that speaks pretty poorly of him too. I don't know which is worse, being a total ignoramus or being a demagogue. You decide which is worse. I don't know. He's totally wrong about all of it. Adam Smith said there's nothing more absurd than this doctrine, the whole doctrine of the balance of trade. So that was written in 1776 or published in 1776. people, we've had enough time now to learn that trade is good and government interference with trade, our trading activities, is bad. We're poor as a result of it. Mm. And trade wars can break out, which means we have access to fewer goods. That's bad. Americans who might want to sell their goods abroad, and all power to them if they want to do that, will have fewer opportunities to do that because of the foreigners will have fewer dollars because they're selling less here, but also they'll put their governments will be
well,
stupid.
Well, these policies help somebody, though, right? I mean, it seems like supply is organized and demand is unorganized. So, well, and supply hates demand because demand is never high enough. So supply always wants to bribe government to and do some rent seeking at the expense of the consumer, right?
That's the irony. Trump likes to portray himself as a populist and an America First guy. But it's not populism. It's elitism. If the steel industry, which is highly organized and the steel workers with them, can lobby for tariffs and keep out foreign steel or make it much more expensive so that it's priced out of the market, that helps in the short run. It helps a few steel workers, you know, and those companies. But there are many more steel buyers in the United States than steel producers. Like, think of all the industries, auto, everything else, airplanes, that need steel as an input. They have to buy steel. They're hurt because now they have to spend more on steel, more money on steel. So their products are more expensive, and they have a harder time selling those products. And then consumers, of course, are hurt by all this. So to help a very small number of people, everybody else is hurt. I'm not even talking about foreigners. They're hurt too. So how is that populism in America First if you're helping a small group of Americans and hurting every other American, again, not to mention the foreigners? How is that populism and America First? It's not. It's a big lie. Now, again, either he knows this and he lies about it or he doesn't understand it, in which case, what the hell is he doing? He doesn't even understand such a basic thing as trade.
Yep.
It's just unbelievable what he says day in and day out about trade. It's just unbelievable. And then he has this idiot Peter Navarro in his ear who thinks we should have a trade war basically with everybody. It's just incredible.
Now, you know what? I wish I'd had you on the line, too, when I was talking with Mike Swanson a little while ago about Federal Reserve interest rate policy and Trump's tax cut policy, but now his tariff policy, where, you know, all of these things are either accentuate or contradict each other in terms of being stimulative and expansionist type policies or fighting against that tendency. But so I didn't bring up trade in that conversation, but so this is really That's contrary right. to his overall policy, which is cut taxes and try to claim sky high, record high everything's and take credit for all that, right?
No, that's right. He's going to muddy the results of the deregulation that has occurred. There's been deregulation.
Oh, right. Deregulation as well as the tax cuts, yeah.
And so, and also the cutting of the tax rates and some simplification. It was hardly revolutionary, but some simplification, taking less money from people. He's going to muddy the outcome of that with trade wars, which is going to, you know, we'll force up prices and make fewer goods available to Americans and hurt lots of American companies. We're already seeing the results every day. There's stories in the press about firms that are harmed. I mean, the craft beer industry is harmed because kegs are going to cost more money because of the steel and the aluminum tariffs. That's going to muddy up he's interested in these national economic statistics. They're going to look worse. He's not going to be able to point to clear benefits from his tax. And what will get blamed, of course, will be the tax, right? The people that want to raise taxes will blame the tax cut for any bad results. They won't blame the trade policies. And so he's not even helping himself. I don't understand. I don't know if there's anybody that could talk sense to him on this subject. This has at least been one consistent thing in Trump's career. He's been a protectionist like all the time. This is not some new position he's thought up during the campaign. So he's stuck to this one, which doesn't speak well for him, but it's not some new thing that somebody just talked him into. It's very bad. I mean, trade wars can be extremely destructive. And I mean, if you know, there are plenty of things not to like about these bilateral trade or multilateral trade deals like NAFTA. There's always bad stuff like intellectual property laws and stuff like that. But they do, to some extent, in something like NAFTA, basically got rid of tariffs, except for the few things they made exceptions for, like the sugar lobby so strong that they could exclude sugar from the free trade. But it did get rid of tariffs, which is great for everybody. If he kills that, it's unbelievable what disruption that'll be, because the three countries, their structure of production is so integrated now, with suppliers and going in all directions, supplies, vendors, inputs to producers here that originate in Mexico or Canada. That's a very fragile structure, not fragile sort of economically, but fragile politically. The government is like a bull in a china shop. And if he, tears that up and destroys any, to the extent we have a free trade zone in North America, that's going to be extremely harmful to an awful lot of business owners, employees, and consumers. And he doesn't seem to even understand that.
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, you guys, that's Sheldon Richman. The column is TGIF. The goal is freedom. Runs every Friday at the Libertarian Institute, libertarianinstitute.org. This one is called Trump, North Korea, and Iran. Thanks again, Sheldon.
Anytime, Scott. Look forward to talking to you next week.
Absolutely.